speaker this evening is Dattler Schlichter. He's had we were delighted to welcome. He's had a 19-year career in international financial markets. Worked at J.P. Morgan, Merrill Lynch, and Western Asset Management, among other companies. And he left the industry in 2009 to focus on his book, Paper Money Collapse, which is what I think he's going to be talking about this evening. So welcome, Dattler, and the floor is yours.
Thanks so much, thank you. Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak to you this evening. I'd like to present you this evening some of the key theses and the outlook that I developed in my book, Paper Money Collapse. Since the book came out in September 2011, I spoke about the book on a couple of occasions, and some of my presentations are on YouTube or on my website. I try to make each of these talks slightly different, and I will try to do the same this evening. So I hope what I have to say is of some interest to those who you have never heard about the book and have not read it, but it's also hopefully of some interest to those who have heard me speak about it and may have even read the book. Paper Money Collapse, the book, presents what I hope is a coherent and logical economic argument. It argues the case. And it argues the case against the current mainstream consensus, what I call the current mainstream consensus, certainly in financial markets and in the media, and I think to a large degree also in academia. That consensus maintains that there should be something like monetary policy. It is good to have such a thing as monetary policy. While most economists today readily accept that the market is a superior mechanism for allocating scarce resources and allocating those resources efficiently, when it comes to money, the current consensus maintains that money should be controlled by the state, that there should be something like a central bank, and that there should be something like monetary policy. Specifically, monetary affairs should be organized in such a way that the money supply constantly expands, so that the purchasing power of money constantly declines at a specific, officially sanctioned rate, and that when the economy for any reason gets into difficulties or we experience a recession, that more money should be injected into the economy, that the economy should be re-stimulated by lower interest rates and extra monetary expansion. That is sort of the current consensus, and it is believed that such a system, which I call an elastic monetary system, is a better way to guarantee monetary and economic stability. I argue that this consensus is wrong, that the assumptions are wrong. Such a monetary system, I argue, is inherently incompatible with free market capitalism. First of all, such a monetary system has not evolved as a result of market forces. It's not the outcome of a market evolution, but it's obviously the result of political decisions, as we can clearly see in the monetary system that we have today, the way it came about. It's not the result of market factors or the spontaneous interaction of the trading public. It is a political institution. But more importantly, I think it can be argued that the constant expansion of such a monetary system, the constant monetary expansion, must destabilize the economy. Specifically, monetary expansion goes through the banking system and the financial industry and the financial markets, where this constant monetary expansion will lower interest rates in a free market economy are important market prices that coordinate savings and investment and coordinate the capital allocation in an economy. These processes are systematically distorted by constant and ongoing monetary expansion. And therefore, imbalances will accrue. We have misallocations of capital, which after some time leads to recessions. And in our monetary system now, the elastic money system is being used to counter these recessions, as I said, with accelerated monetary expansion, which does not allow the market to liquidate any imbalances from the previous expansion, but causes the system to accumulate dislocations and imbalances over time and makes the system progressively more unstable. So what I argue is that such a system is what is first of all not needed, it's not necessary, and I will explain that in a few moments. means. What I mean by that is even a growing economy does not need a growing supply of money. So it's superfluous. But more than that, it is inherently unstable. It will lead to imbalances, growing imbalances over time. It's ultimately unsustainable. The monetary system we have today will end badly, and probably even soon. Because the further point I make is that given the imbalances and distortions that have already accumulated, I argue that the end game of this monetary system may already be fast approaching. I mean, the first point you can make is here, or the first counterpoint is obviously that this seems to be a very bold statement, and maybe you could even say an arrogant one, because who am I to challenge sort of this widespread consensus? Obviously, that evidently many sort of very very smart people subscribe to. Well, I will argue in my book that I think some of the greatest minds of economic theory would actually support my case. I would argue that one of the key notions through the history of monetary economics, all the way from Richard Cantillon in the early 18th century to, I would argue, Ludwig von Mises in 1912 in his seminal book on money and credit, one of the persistent notions through the history of monetary economics was the idea that monetary expansion, the injection of new money into the economy, is a destabilizing factor. That has long been a topic. The British currency school, David Ricardo, there was a dominant theory there, and I would argue that the most sophisticated and most developed theory about this was developed by Ludwig von Mises in the early part of the 20th century. So it's not something that I think is necessarily a new insight, but one that seems to have been pushed aside rather than being rejected over the last sort of 60, 70, or 80 years. Well, if you look back 100 years ago, I would argue, in 1912, I would say that most economists, politicians, and bankers would have maintained that a global free market system, a global capitalism, requires a form of money that is hard, that is apolitical, and that's international. And that is why almost all industrialized nations subscribed to the gold standard. Money was hard, international, and apolitical. Today, obviously, we have money that is soft, it is certainly political, and it's now national, because most countries control their central banks and have domestic, local currencies. 100 years ago, in 1913, one of the most powerful banks back then, John Pierpont Morgan, said, gold is money and nothing else. It was one of his statements. And 80 years ago, almost to the day, in April of 1933, when President Roosevelt made the first steps towards taking the US dollar off gold, he did this, interestingly, by endorsing what was the Thomas Amendment of the Agricultural Adjustment Act, which was a populist part of monetary legislation that was slipped into the Agricultural Adjustment Act, the Thomas Amendment. The Thomas Amendment, for the first time, allowed the US president to simply issue paper money or to, via discretionary decisions, change the gold content of the US dollar. So when it became clear that Roosevelt would endorse this, his own budget director, Lewis William Douglas, said, this is the end of Western civilization. Now, what I argue, in a way, is that Douglas was correct. Now, it sounds like a grand statement, and it's 80 years ago, and civilization is still standing. But please remember that after the Second World War, we had the Bretton Woods system, and which was designed to a large degree by John Maynard Keynes, who was no big fan of the gold standard. But even under Bretton Woods, a link to gold was maintained, and the objective here was clearly to provide some constraint to the creation of fiat money, of paper money, and to not allow money to become a tool of politics. The Bretton Woods system practically ended on August 15, 1971, when Richard Nixon again decided, rather unilaterally, to close the gold window and take the dollar off gold internationally as well. So the current monetary system is really only 42 years old. There were some constraints still in place until 1971. So if you look at 40 years or 80 years, you know, I don't think this is a very long time if you think about major economic deformations. And I think the full consequences of these decisions are only more recently being felt to their full. I'll give you another quote by Ludwig von Mises, who I mentioned earlier, who in a private correspondence in 1965 wrote, "If our civilization will not, in the next years or decades, completely collapse, the gold standard will be restored." And again, I argue that sort of the importance that these people put on, you know, a monetary constraint on time money in some shape or form to something that was not easily expandable, something that was fundamentally scarce and therefore limited the ability of states and equally of banks to expand the money supply, was believed to be a cornerstone of the free market system. And I do think that this was, you know, this was ultimately correct. So before I present sort of the key points of my book, I maybe should address a few misconceptions that can quickly come up about the book and that I've been confronted with over the last 2 years that the book has been out. Where misconception one is sort of, you know, I wrote my book to propose monetary reform. That is not really the case. I mean, if you talk about reform, it's I think the idea is always that we suggest how we could run the monetary system better, and then it's all about convincing people that, you know, we should make certain changes. And if the public does not pick up on these proposals, then the system will continue in this unreformed state. I don't think that's really my message. My message is really clearly that this system is unstable, it's inherently unstable, it is approaching its endgame. So I do think that the system is unsustainable. And so I'm not proposing reform, I just want to hopefully engage my audience in this discussion about the unsustainability of the system. I don't consider myself a monetary reformer. Certainly there are implications of what I have to say, and I do think at some stage we need to and will return to a monetary system in which the money supply is more constrained. The misconception too is, because of the title, Paper Money Collapse, some people think that the book predicts imminent hyperinflation. Now obviously we don't have hyperinflation right now, and we may not have it anytime soon, so therefore, you know, the prediction of the book is not coming true, and we, as long as that doesn't happen, we can ignore this point of view. I think that's incorrect. I think, again, my key message is to show and discuss the inherent instability of the system. Hyperinflation is just one endgame of the system, there are others. I think the number of endgames is severely limited. There are only few end scenarios we can think of. Hyperinflation is one. I still do believe it's the most likely, but that is one we can discuss, but it's not necessarily the only outcome. I think another, and I will add one more thing here, because we've not seen a meaningful rise in inflation. We've certainly not seen hyperinflation in recent years. The question comes up, have recent events made me more convinced about my outlook or less convinced about my outlook? I spent 20 years in financial markets, and I can tell you, if I look back through my career in finance, most of the major developments I've observed and I've been part of, I think, fit my description and my prediction of growing instability very well. So I do think the events of the last 40 years, 20 years, certainly the events of recent years leading up to and including the recent financial crisis, I think confirm my position or support it. But also the events, the policy responses and the economic development since the book came out, since September 2011, I feel have further, you know, supported my key thesis. There's another misconception maybe that the book is written by a market practitioner. As I said, I spent 20 years in financial markets. I left the financial industry to write the book. There could be the misconception that this is a book written by a practitioner, so it's all about sort of my view, my experiences in financial markets, and a book that heavily focuses on recent events or the recent crisis. That is also not the case. I think if you read the book, you see it's more written from the point of view of economic theory. As I said, I try to make a a case, an arguable, a logically consistent case here. So it, I think it reads much more like an economics book, not a textbook, but maybe a semi-academic book, than you know, the reflections of a market practitioner. There are no anecdotes in it. There are no personal market experiences in the book. It is really sort of an economic case. But there's another misconception that maybe, you know, the book is just simply arguing a return to the gold standard. Again, I'm not seeing myself necessarily here as a reformer, or there is no plan in the book of, you know, what we should do and how we could all change this. I do think the book rehabilitates the gold standard. I think it shows that it was a mistake to take currencies off gold and to lose any kind of anchor. That the monetary system has practically become unhinged as a result of this, of these decisions, which were decisions that were not driven by economic theory or any advances in monetary economics, but decisions that were always the result of sort of economic, sort of political expediency. So my book argues that these were mistakes, and that if we had stuck with the gold standard or some similar system, many of our present problems would not be with us. But I don't necessarily argue for a return to the system that we had between 1879 or 1914 or 1933. I think we need to get back at some stage to a more inelastic system. I think how that system is constructed and how it should work should be left to the market. And I assume the market will again take something like gold as the basis for a monetary system. But that is a decision, you know, I definitely don't want to make. It's not the key point of my book. So let me summarize some of the key sort of messages in the book, and try to sort of hit on the key points that hopefully support this thesis. Well, the first point I make is sort of, if you think conceptually about monetary systems, we can divide them into roughly two sorts of monetary systems. And the important point here for me is the elasticity of the money supply. And that's why I call our current system an elastic monetary system. And the opposite of that is obviously an inelastic system. So we can think of about a system like a gold standard in which the supply of money is inherently inelastic. Where even under gold standard conditions, money is not entirely inelastic. First of all, you know, people can mine gold and get it into circulation. However, that is very costly and it takes time, and we all know that even today with sort of modern mining techniques, the supply of gold, the outstanding volume of gold, increases only very, very marginally every year. But for the sake of my argument, we can even ignore this completely. I would have no problem if mining stopped and we had an entirely fixed supply of gold. Secondly, obviously, over the last 300 years, you know, modern banking development, banks have always been fractional reserve banks. The banks have always been also in the business of issuing money derivatives, so banknotes and bank deposits that are not backed by gold. They did this even under gold standard conditions. That has always increased the supply of what the public used as money beyond what was available in the form of gold, and introduced an element of elasticity into the money supply, which was in fact the reason why economists, even 200 years ago, investigated the effects of monetary elasticity. So there's another element of elasticity that we observed under the gold standard. But again, for the sake of the argument, let's ignore these points and let's look at an entirely inelastic system, such as a proper, you know, 100% gold standard. And then there are elastic monetary systems, like modern paper money systems, fiat money systems, in which the supply of money is entirely, you know, unrestricted. Now, obviously, in a paper money system, not everybody is allowed to print money. Printing money is always the prerogative of the state, and that's why all paper money systems are fiat systems in which money is being issued under the state, under a state monopoly. I think the first point I make about elasticity is that most people struggle with the concept of inelastic money, because most people think that a growing economy needs elastic money. A growing economy means we have more goods and services, so we have more transactions every year. Money is the medium of exchange. In order to transact more goods and services, we need more money. So I think intuitively, most people feel that it makes sense to have constant monetary expansion. A growing economy needs more money. And this is a fundamental misunderstanding of money. Money is different from any other good or service because money is the only good that you demand only for its exchange value. Your money itself has no use value. Whether you use gold or paper money or modern computer money, which is just bits on a computer hard drive, none of these things give you any direct use value. They only give you exchange value. Nobody who demands money has a demand for a certain number of paper notes or a certain weight of gold or silver. What you demand a certain quantity of these monetary assets because of the exchange value they give you, because of the purchasing power. Now, if the demand for money changes, you can just allow the market to adjust the exchange value of the monetary asset, and that will automatically meet the extra demand for money. So let's assume we have a community where most people suddenly have a higher demand for money. What that means is people want to hold more of their wealth in its most readily tradable form, in its most readily exchangeable form, and that is money. Money is always the most fungible good in the economy, the one that can most readily and easily be exchanged for goods and services. So the demand for purchasing power in the form of money goes up. So what would people do? People will sell non-money goods for the money good, for whatever the money good is, or they will reduce their money outlays for non-money goods and that way try to accumulate higher money balances. But if more people do this, it obviously means that prices go down, and the opposite of that, the flip side of that, is that the purchasing power of the monetary asset goes up. Well, we could call that deflation. And the other way, if the demand for money goes down, people will spend money, try to get rid of their money balances, and prices will go up and the purchasing power of money goes down. But let's go back to the first case. The demand for money goes up. So people want to hold more of their wealth in the form of money. They bid up the purchasing power of money, and simply by this act, the market automatically will satisfy the extra demand for money. Because now there is no more physical money in the economy. There are no more paper notes in the economy, and there are no more gold coins in the economy. But each of these units now buy more goods and services. So people hold now more exchange value in the form of money, and that is exactly what money demand means. You only demand money for its exchange value, not for its use value. So the peculiar thing about money is that it's the most fungible good in the economy, and the only one you only demand for is exchange value. That is why any change in money demand can be automatically satisfied by simply allowing the market to adjust the exchange value of money. And this happens automatically by people transacting, buying and selling money versus non-money goods according to their own money demand. The public is in full control here. The public can hold at any moment in time exactly the amount of money in terms of money exchange value, money purchasing power, that it wants to hold. So that's the first one. There is no need for a money producer. Even in a growing economy, there is no need for somebody to constantly produce money. It should not surprise us because for most of human history, money was gold or silver, and for most of these economies, at least in the short run, nobody could easily supply extra gold or silver. So therefore, it should not surprise us that conceptually, we can explain why inelastic forms of money are perfectly compatible with growing and dynamic economies. Now, I think the immediate response from mainstream economists will be, well, that must mean that we have constant swings in the purchasing power of money. That must mean that if the demand for money goes up, we have deflation. If the demand for money goes down, we have inflation. So that in itself must introduce instability. And that is not really the case, and we can again see this conceptually. If a certain part of the population suddenly feels they want to have a higher demand for money, they want to hold more of their wealth in form of money, in readily exercisable purchasing power. So these people bid up the purchasing power of the monetary unit. But the other group of people in the economy, who we have to assume have not changed their demand for money, they have the same demand for money as they had before. But suddenly, whatever money balances they hold, these money balances suddenly buy more goods and services. So the opportunity cost of holding money goes up. I could rather spend the money. A smaller money balance will now meet my unchanged demand for money. So these people will readily spend the money and therefore hand it over to the people who have a higher money demand. I'm not saying, and nobody can say, that this will always mean a stable purchasing power of money. In fact, the idea of a state with purchasing power, money is a myth, you know, because in a dynamic economy, it will never be entirely stable. And there's now a bit of an obsession with purchasing power stability. But we can see from this conceptual analysis that there is no reason to believe that it will be unduly volatile, that we have big swings in the purchasing power of money. And again, this is something that we can confirm very easily by just looking into history. I mean, through the long periods of time when money was gold or silver and it supplied fairly inelastic, not only did it stop economies from growing and from trade expanding, we also see that there was no major inflation or deflation in these economies. In fact, you know, for most of the time, the purchasing power of money was incredibly stable. Over long history, the periods of British history, is fairly nicely documented how stable prices were. In fact, economists only really began to investigate inflation and deflation as monetary phenomena that would destabilize the economy in those periods and when the link between money and gold or silver was set. You know, for example, in between 1797 and 1821, when, you know, William Pitt took the pound sterling off gold to fund the war against France. That's when we had the bullion debate in Britain, and some of the economists discussed this new phenomenon of inflation. So again, it will not be. We don't need elastic money. Elastic money can accommodate a growing economy. It does not lead to undue fluctuations in the purchasing power of money. There's one other objection that will come at this point usually, which is, well, over longer periods of time, it must mean deflation. Because if the economy grows and provides more goods and services, but there is the same amount of money needs to accommodate now growing number of transactions, that means that there will be a trend for the purchasing power of money to go up. There will be secular deflation. And again, this is absolutely no problem. If it happens, that's absolutely no reason to believe that this will lead to economic instability. Well, first of all, think about it this way. The advocates of our current monetary system suggest that it would be better to have 2% inflation. But why would it be better for economic actors if they knew or could reasonably expect inflation prices to go up by 2% every year? And in a deflationary environment, they can expect prices to go down by 1% or 2% every year. They will incorporate this in their contracts, in their loan contracts, and in their lending and borrowing, just the same way that people anticipate inflation rate. So if you can have a stable economy, as the advocates of our current system tell us, if inflation constantly is 2%, what's the problem with 2% deflation? Now, here again, I think this is one of the things that gets me often aggravated, because if you read some of the financial press, there's often this talk about, you know, Japan being in deflation and that holds the economy back because nobody's spending money anymore, because I know that prices go down, so I postpone all my consumption decisions because prices are lower tomorrow, if I don't spend my money now, and then I don't spend it tomorrow either, because tomorrow I will know that it's even lower the next day, so I never spend the money, which is obviously nonsense. And we all can see this. I mean, what this view completely ignores is the phenomenon of time preference, which is something that we all experience. If we didn't experience it, then we wouldn't act. It's an inherent factor of human action, this time preference. And you can see this very clearly in those goods and services, in particular those goods, where prices have been declining and will probably continue to decline, even in our inflationary economies. You know, things like smartphones, laptops, a lot of consumer electronic items. Prices are falling, but people still buy the latest BlackBerry or iPhone. And the reason is, we can clearly explain this very easily. It is time preference. You know, it's not the same for me whether I have a new phone today or in 5 years' time. It's not. And in 5 years' time, it may be 4% cheaper, but I think the pain of waiting for 4 years is just greater. And this is the same with other economic goods. By the way, I add one more thing to this: is, you know, Japan does not really have deflation because prices have not hardly changed over the last 10 years. So, by any reasonable measure, I would argue that Japan has 2% inflation. There's no reason to believe that is the reason the economy is growing poorly. And in fact, there's been lots of historic studies about economies, the US economy, the British economy, in the 19th century, long stretches of falling prices, and those were not a hindrance to growth. So So we have all, we covered all these points, I think, but so the inelastic money can accommodate a growing economy, does not lead to big swings in the price level, and it may lead over time to moderate secular deflation, which is not a problem. Indeed, I argue in the book it has many advantages, secular deflation, one of them being that you can save by holding money, which would give you a small real return. So there are even advantages for having a deflationary system rather than an inflationary one. But the key point here is that even if we had a monetary producer, if we have now an elastic monetary system, and we would charge the money producer with the goal of stabilizing the purchasing power of money, not to allow the deflation, the secular deflation, but more importantly, to even counter any changes, any sudden changes in money demand. Because as I explained before, if there is a major sudden change in money demand, if suddenly people want to hold more money or less money, that must be reflected in the purchasing power of money. That will lead to money prices either falling or rising. And I agree that this phenomenon in itself can have destabilizing effects on the economy. So, but what if we have a now money producer who is charged with the job of countering these moves? Well, the first point I'd make is, it's completely impossible for anybody to stabilize the purchasing power of money. Because remember, the moment people have a higher demand for money, they will immediately reduce their money outlays on non-money goods, or even sell non-money goods into the market and try to acquire higher cash balances. What I mean is, people will immediately act on that changed desire to hold money. And when the prices then change, and we have a period of deflation, let's say, in response to higher money demand, that deflation is in itself sufficient to completely meet that rise in money demand. Again, remember, money has only exchange value, no use value. If the public has a higher demand for cars or for mobile phones, somebody has to produce more cars or mobile phones because these are things that use value. Money has exchange value. The rise in money's purchasing power, the price change of money, is fully sufficient to meet the rising demand in money for money. So therefore, let's look at our money producer now. So he suddenly is confronted with falling prices, which tell him quite clearly that the demand for money has gone up. But first of all, it's now too late to avoid this effect. If he wanted to stabilize the purchasing power of money, it's already too late, because it already has happened, the deflation has already occurred. So his mission of keeping the purchasing power stable, he has already failed. And now there is no point for him to print extra money to meet the extra money demand, because people have already satisfied that extra demand for money by simply allowing money prices to fall and the purchasing power of the monetary unit to rise. So, again, I think some of the key notions that I think hinder many people to see the advantages of inelastic money, or some people see problems with inelastic money that I think clearly do not exist. I think on the other hand, though, and this is, I think, probably even a more important part now, we can show that elastic forms of money must destabilize the economy. Again, I mentioned earlier that this is a long-standing idea or suspicion of economists, and many economists have looked at this, said that a sudden expansion of money will lead to economic dislocations. And what I do in the book is I start with a very simple model of an economy where suddenly at some point you inject money into the economy. And it's very clear that in any kind of realistic model of an economy, money cannot be injected in such a way that the money instantly reaches everybody in the economy at the same time. So you always have to inject money at a certain point and then allow transactions to occur that will distribute the extra money balances. And obviously we all know since, as I said before, Richard Cantillon, who wrote in the early 18th century, that when we have such a monetary expansion and therefore an inflation, that not all prices respond at the same time and not all prices respond to the same degree. And this is the result of the process I just described. The money is not reaching everybody instantaneously. The money is going from one point in the economy to other points and is being distributed. So not all prices will rise at the same time and to the same degree, which always means that at the end of the monetary expansion process, you will have changed relative prices. And if you change relative prices, you will have changed the way resources are allocated. So therefore, you will have changed the employment and the use of real resources. You will have certainly affected income distribution and wealth distribution. Any monetary expansion creates winners and losers. And in a very simple model, you can show that the beneficiaries of monetary expansion are always the early recipients. The people who get the money first, before it has begun to circulate through the entire economy, are the ones who can spend the money that they get first from the money producer before it has lost its purchasing power, before you know a lot of prices in the economy have responded to this inflow of money. And so therefore, as I said, it always changes resource, it changes relative prices, it changes resource allocation and resource use. So it also changes what the economy produces. I think today one of the problems with these discussions that you see in the media is often that there is this perception that we inject money into the economy that will stimulate the economy and will, on the margin, lead to somewhat higher prices. But the idea is always that we all benefit from the extra growth and that we all have the disadvantage of the loss of purchasing power. And that is not the case. Actually, the earlier recipients will probably benefit much more from the extra growth from the extra transactions that are possible with the extra money or that be instigated by the extra money before the money lost the purchasing power. There will be some people in some parts of the economy that will get the money much later, and they will probably only suffer the inflationary effects of the money and not benefit from the extra transactions at all. So the idea that this would just lift all boats simultaneously is one that can be easily be refuted. But obviously in a modern economy, all monetary expansion occurs via the financial system. So the point in the economy where the extra money comes in is always the banking system. I mean, I mentioned fractional reserve banking earlier. That is, for the last 300 years, that has been the most elegant way of, and the only way really by which you can get large amounts of new money into the economy is via the banking system and via the financial system. So that is the point now where the money enters the economy. And not surprisingly, that's where the people are located that are the largest beneficiaries of monetary expansion. Now, what this money does, it will obviously now have an effect on interest rates. As I mentioned before, interest rates are important market prices. Indeed, interest rates are relative prices. They're price ratios that are an important factor in communicating the public's time preference to the various producers in the economy. So by coordinating saving and investment, if we can envision a process by which interest rates fall and extra investment is stimulated, and that process being initiated by a growing propensity to save. So let's assume people save more, they curtail consumption. That means they're shifting resources from current consumption into investment and savings, so they save these resources, they make them available on the loan market. The extra funds that become available on the loan market will lower interest rates. At lower interest rates, more investment projects become profitable. Entrepreneurs will take on the extra loans on the credit market, the capital market, and realize extra investment projects. And they use, obviously, real resources for doing this. And these are the resources that the savers, that the consumers slash savers have saved by their decision to save. And this is really, sort of in a nutshell, sort of the economic growth model of a capitalist economy. You know, out of real income, you have real savings, which is foregone consumption, and that funds the capital stock, which allows higher productivity, which allows higher real incomes, and therefore allows higher real savings. You can expand the capital stock, and that's one way by which the economy gets richer and wealthier. A similar process happens if you inject new money into the economy, where now nobody has saved, nobody has curtailed present consumption, nobody has made a decision that resources should be allocated from present-day consumption to future consumption, which is saving. But for the entrepreneurs who look at the capital markets, it looks the same. Interest rates are falling and extra funds are available. Now, these are not saved funds. These are not just printed money. But the entrepreneurs cannot really distinguish. How could they? So they will again start investment projects and obviously use the extra money to realize investment projects. But in order to realize investment projects, they need real resources, which they try to bid away from the consumers, which don't want to give them up because they won't consume them. They never decided to save, and therefore never decided to make real resources available for, you know, a build up of a real capital stock. So what I just explained is in a nutshell, in a very simplified form, what has become known as the Austrian business cycle theory. Now, Ludwig von Mises really is the reason we call it the Austrian business cycle theory. Ludwig von Mises, who first elaborated this in his 1912 book, Theory of Money and Credit, he didn't really want to call it the Austrian business cycle theory because he knew that he was building on work by the British classical economists who already worked on similar ideas in the 19th century. But Mises wanted to apply the new marginalist theories that had come up in the late 19th century, in particular the ideas of Karl Menger, a fellow Austrian, and wanted to incorporate those into monetary theory. And in doing so, in using marginal subjective economic theory, which was very new in the early part of the 20th century, used that to explain monetary phenomena, he practically formulated a superior business cycle theory, and that was then called the Austrian business cycle theory. Now, it's called a business cycle theory, but I don't think that's really a good description any longer for what we have today. Because remember, when Mises formulated this theory, or even British classical economists, we had a goal set. So the monetary expansion that these economists looked at, was a very different kind of monetary expansion than what we have today. What it basically was is money proper was gold, as J.P. Morgan said. Gold is money and nothing else. But banks managed to issue bank deposits and bank notes on top of the gold stock, and thereby expand, by simply lowering their reserve ratios, they could expand the money supply. And this was, and the theory basically said that this kind of marginal elasticity is a good explanation, or is the best explanation, I would argue, for the business cycle phenomena that people saw even under gold standard conditions. But as long as there was a gold anchor, there was, in a way, a self-correcting mechanism here, because obviously the banks, when they expand the balance sheet and create these money derivatives, there's a point in which their reserve ratios become too low, and they curtailing their lending again and their money creation. That usually then starts a recession, and in the recession, a lot of these investment projects that were started based on easy money and not based on saving were then liquidated in the following recession. So you had a money-induced credit boom and then a credit bust and a correction. So this was a business cycle theory, but you had two parts of the cycle, the boom and the bust. Now what we have since we've done away with the gold anchor and now moved to a system of complete, you know, fiat money and entirely unrestricted money creation, is that now we try to short circuit the bust. So the system, the way it's designed now, still allows for the boom. So that, you know, banks expand lending based on money creation, banks lower reserve ratios, more credit gets extended by money creation. That leads to a boom. Still a phenomenon we see today. But for the last 40 years, whenever the cycle turns and you get to a point where banks become more concerned about their balance sheet or their capital ratios, cut back on the lending, and the economy rolls over and goes into recession, we now have the central banks, who are now lenders of last resort and increasingly in the business of managing the economy, they come forward now and can print extra bank reserves, lower interest rates administratively, which is, again, a new role that did not have really under gold standard conditions, lower interest rates, print more bank reserves. Bank reserves are no longer gold. Bank reserves is just electronic money that the central bank can create at will and without limit. So whenever the economy now goes into the bust, you don't get the cleansing recession, or you only get a little bit of it, and then we add more money to the system and allow the cycle to continue. Now what this means is that if the Austrians are correct, and I think they are, it necessarily means that now these imbalances must accumulate over time. And it must mean that the economy becomes increasingly unstable and increasingly in need of some sort of cleansing, some kind of recession that will allow the market to liquidate these accumulated imbalances. And in fact, what we've seen, I think, very clearly over the last 20 years in particular, is that the monetary, the entire economy globally has become ever more dependent on cheap money, on very aggressive expansion of bank reserves, and very, very low interest rates. In fact, any attempt over the last 20 years by any of the central banks to kind of normalize interest rates, to go back to interest rate levels that were historically more normal, even to 4 or 5% as the Fed tried back in 2005, not only do we see a recession, we almost see immediately a financial a crisis, because the system is now so levered, because it will never, has never really been allowed over in recent decades to completely liquidate and go back into some form of balance. So I think that this is a view that clearly comes from the Austrian business cycle theory, but adapts it to our current monetary system, in which you do not have the gold as an anchor that pulls the system back to some kind of balance. Now, obviously, the recessions are painful, and people like Mises always said, well, if you want to avoid the recession, you have to avoid the artificial boom, right? I mean, you should not try to encourage growth and by artificially lowering interest rates. If interest rates are low because people save, that's fine. But if interest rates are low because you're simply printing money and encourage banks to lower their reserve ratios and create money out of thin air, you will get a boom-bust cycle. You will not get lasting growth and prosperity. So obviously that did not make the Austrians very popular whenever there was a recession, because nobody cared how we got in there. People just wanted to get out of it. And this is why I think that in our modern system today, I think we have compounded these problems much further. Now, at this point, I will maybe say a few words about my own experience here, just to close my remarks, and then we can discuss this. But before I do this, let me just give you one quote, which I think is essential, and I use this quote twice in my book. In 1949, Ludwig von Mises explained it such. He said, "There is no means of avoiding the final collapse of a boom brought about by credit expansion. The alternative is only whether the crisis should come sooner as the result of a voluntary abandonment of further credit expansion, or later as a final and total catastrophe of the currency system involved." And that is, in a way, the situation we're in right now, and the situation we've maneuvered ourselves into. Because over the last 20 years in particular, I argue, central banks globally have always tried to avoid these recessions and these periods of liquidation and credit contraction. You know, to allow a meaningful deleveraging of the financial system was stopped whenever there were early signs that this could happen. But as we do this, obviously, the imbalances become ever larger, the system becomes ever more highly geared and highly levered, and we can see this in many, many indicators. So now we're probably at a point where none of the central bankers even dares to not provide more money to the system. And this is the reason why now we are in a situation where, you know, around the world, all the major central banks are now practically at zero interest rates, and all the major central banks are now using their own balance sheet to prop up the system. A few words about my own background here, or my own experience in this. Obviously, you'll have 2 more minutes.
Yeah, I want to say.
Now, this is the Oxford Hayek Society, so I should say a few words about Hayek. Now, you will see from my talk and from my book in particular that I think I owe my personal largest intellectual debt to Ludwig von Mises, who I think was the outstanding economist of the 20th century. But Hayek worked with Mises and was, in a way, a protege of Mises in the early part of the 20th century. He was about 17, 18 years younger than Mises. Hayek was sort of my introduction into sort of Austrian school economics. I studied economics in Germany, and studied economics and business, and became very interested in these things, but I remember towards the end of my studies, we read some text by Hayek, and that sort of really ignited my interest in economic theory, really, and also in political philosophy, and certainly in the Austrian School of Economics. And I read sort of Austrian, first of all, I read probably everything that Hayek ever wrote. I started a career in finance in 1990, so I never went into academia. I went into finance, and I worked in Frankfurt first, and later in London. And I remember when I came to London in 1996, I even contemplated for some time buying Hayek's old house. He used to live in the 1930s at 8 Turner Close, Hampstead Garden suburb. But interesting, that house came on the market in the mid-1990s. I did not buy it. But so for a long time, I considered myself a Hayekian. And I read everything he wrote, and then I read sort of, obviously, Mises, Rothbard, and some of the other writers, Karl Menger, Böhm, Bardeck. I think probably today I would have to call myself a Misesian. I think that Mises is somewhat different in theory, in some of his methodology and some of his theories from some of the other Austrian writers, and I think that he's probably the most consistent and most impressive. But throughout all these years, that was a hobby of mine. I used to work in financial markets, but it was very interesting that I think from the late 1990s, it was clearly evident that the system was getting increasingly unstable. And I remember some of the key moments that from those days. I remember in 1998, and by the time it was probably already deeply steeped in Austrian schools, so I understood the whole business cycle thing. And in 1996, Alan Greenspan, then the chairman of the US Fed, given a speech that is famous to this day. He gave a speech where he said, when he was first talking about irrational exuberance. So he was basically giving a hint that he felt financial markets were overly optimistic, and we had a massive bull market in equities, not least in technology stocks, and he felt that this was all going too far. And then, so then in 1998, obviously the bubble had to burst, and the trigger was the fall of Russia in August 1998. And shortly after that, a major hedge fund, a long-term capital management, LTCM, got into trouble and faced default. And at the time, so suddenly, a lot of the markets shut down, big sell-off in risk assets, and we all were affected by this, obviously. But I felt that, Greenspan would not lower interest rates in this environment, because clearly he even had a tightening bias, he even was leaning towards tightening monetary conditions. And but the moment the hedge fund went under, and some of the big Wall Street firms got affected by this, he lowered interest rates a couple of times and basically provided extra liquidity to the system. And obviously, the liquidation of positions that could have started then, he aborted. And I remember this well because I felt at the time, it's like, if he does this, he's sending the wrong message here to everybody, because it's very clear that even a year or 2 years earlier, he was talking about the market getting ahead of itself and becoming too optimistic. He must clearly realize that maybe at some stage the market needs to liquidate. The market needs to correct. Sometimes these corrections are healthy. And he did not do this. And so obviously then market rallied again. The next point where people were concerned about this whole bull market ending was then at the end of 1999, because we had back then the Y2K phenomenon, where people were concerned that all computers would shut down because we changed from 1999 to 2000. And I kid you not, the Fed did provide extra liquidity for that as well. So within a very short period of time, the Nasdaq moved up the US stock index by another 40%. And obviously, this all then ended in an even bigger burst in 2001 and 2002. 2001, the US had a recession. Obviously, at the 9/11 attacks, terrorist attacks, and in 2002, it experienced the two largest corporate bankruptcies in history, which was WorldCom and which the other Enron and WorldCom. Tiger went bust as well, and now obviously the system was even more geared, but now the Fed could not get away with just cutting interest rates again sort of a few times in between meetings, which it did after LTCM. So now the Fed kept interest rates at 1% for 3 years. And obviously that was then the start of the main housing bubble. It was very clear that from 2002 to 2007, the Fed was, with its easy monetary policy that sort of supported the system, blowing a massive housing bubble, which then burst in 2007. So now 1% interest rates are not enough anymore. So now for the last 5 years we had zero interest rates. And not only in the US, we have that policy in Japan, we have it practically in the Eurozone now, and we have had it for the last 5 years in the UK. All these central banks are now at zero interest rates, all these central banks are now engaged in some shape or form of quantitative easing. And my view is that none of these central banks is even close to reversing any of these strategies. I mean, right now the talk is of implementing negative interest rates at the front and negative policy rates to force yourself more money into the economy. And I think we will see that. I think we'll see more quantitative easing, we will see negative interest rates, because I think that the central banks have now painted themselves into a corner. They do not dare to pull the rug from under an ever more highly geared financial system. So coming back and closing with the Mises quote, I think that is the choice we face. And these are basically the two end games I can see. Either at some stage, a decision is being made to stop money printing and allow the market to price interest rates according to truly available savings and price assets according to their underlying income potential and no longer according to central bank policy or artificially low interest rates and super easy money. If that route is taken, we will obviously then finally get the full liquidation of these imbalances, which will be very painful, extremely painful. Or that is sort of the voluntary abandonment, as Mises calls it. Or we will not see this policy, but then central banks need to be ever more aggressive. They need to manipulate ever more prices, as we see already. Central banks are now, the latest development is that central banks now start buying equities. And they're not only buying short government bonds, as they used to do, now they buy the entire yield curve. They buy, in some countries now, they buy practically all new issues of the state in terms of government securities. And some of the central banks are now starting to buy equities. So the central banks ultimately will get in a position where they need to buy ever more financial assets and manipulate the pricing of ever more financial assets directly. And at some stage, this must lead, and will lead, I think, to higher inflation that will at some point undermine the confidence in paper money. And then we see the scenario that Mises calls the total, the final and total catastrophe of the currency system involved. That was the reason why quotable paper money collapsed. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for an excellent talk, Detlef. I'm sure we'll have some questions, so I'll let you choose the question. You mentioned that the central banks are painting themselves into a corner. What is your view of their view? Do you think, I mean, do they know what's happened and they just can't bear to take the necessary steps, or are they genuinely sort of unaware that this is being done?
Well, it's a good question. My honest answer is I don't know. I really don't know what they are thinking. I do think that it changes. I mean, I think some of the central bankers do honestly believe that what they're doing is simply giving what they call the stimulus. They're just giving that push to the economy, and at some stage it will lead to self-sustained recovery, and then they can run an exit strategy, reduce their balance sheet size, hike interest rates again, as they did before. So I do think some really believe that this will work. I assume that they must get very nervous by now, because after the crisis in 2008, that was the initial response. And if you look back, the Fed, for example, the US Fed, immediately after Lehman bought about $1 trillion of mortgage-backed securities off the US banks and replaced them with freshly printed bank reserves to give extra reserves to the banks. And I think at that point, there was an idea that this is a short-term measure. This will be just stabilize the banks and then allow the system to move on. And obviously that did not work. I mean, we're 5 years in and now the Fed is now conducting what they call open-ended quantitative easing. There is no time limit anymore to it. The Fed is on course this year again to print about $1 trillion of bank reserves. So I think it would surprise me if some of them are not getting nervous. And there are some signs, some people on the Federal Reserve Open Market Committee have alluded to that they feel like we're in uncharted waters. Nobody has ever done this, and nobody ever has extracted themselves from such a policy position. You know, a balance sheet, now the Fed has a balance sheet of about $3 trillion. Some of these balance sheets are now up to 20-30% of GDP. I do think some of them are getting nervous. I mean, some are still true believers, some think that this will ultimately fix it. Some, I think, are getting nervous. And I think there is one, there must be some, I believe, who now basically just do this as an ad hoc basis because they have no choice. They feel like, you know, we cannot, what can we do? We don't want to have a bank run, we don't have an equity market collapse. And just, you know, I think some of them must be getting nervous. I mean, I know I would if I was in their shoes.
So I have 2 points and one question. I'm not an economist, I'm a sociologist. But on the issue of this argument that if there's slight deflation, consumers will constantly postpone consumption or purchases, and therefore the economy won't get off its feet. There seems to be an obvious objection to that, but perhaps it's been refuted, that if there's inflation, sellers will not want to sell because they can postpone selling and get higher prices for it the next day. So I don't know why there's that asymmetry hasn't been addressed, or perhaps it has. In the second place, when you spoke about the issue of the possibility for slight instability, perhaps, under a hard monetary system, at the expense potentially of huge swings caused by these build-ups of assets that need to be liquidated. That reminds me of Nassim Taleb's arguments she's been making in the last few years, in particular that that you don't want to eliminate all volatility from the system because of these kind of self-correcting processes that volatility a low amount introduces. Therefore, a low amount of volatility would seem to be advantage rather than something to be completely eliminated. So if you could comment on that, and in the third place, what do you say to the suggestion that gold is just as arbitrary as paper?
Yeah, very good points. I fully agree with you that the notion that a hard money system with secular deflation will lead to everybody constantly postponing consumption decisions, I think that's nonsense. So I agree with you, and I think it's a very good point. And I don't think it has been even fully addressed. It's a very good point that, you know, the same is true obviously on the other side of sellers, and inflation would immediately stop selling and try to postpone your sales. So it's a very good point. I think it's something that is, just to add to this, the point I made about time preference is key here, because so even if you know that a good you desire, one economist put it very succinctly, he said, to want something means, if all else is equal, to want something means wanting it sooner rather than later. That's always the case. You know, and you can see this logically. If I were to say that I'm, whether I drive this car or not, whether I drive it today or tomorrow, I'm indifferent to this. You know, so, and that means tomorrow, I don't care if I drive it tomorrow or the next day, which means I would be okay if I never drive it, which is very clear that I don't really consider driving the car good. You know, I don't care about driving the car, which is another way. But if you want something, you want it sooner rather than later. And then you always, the only thing that people will have to do is then they consider that time preference with the saving that they get from falling prices. But something similar would actually happen, or does happen, in our economy, as long as you have real positive interest rates. Because if I have positive real interest rates, it means I can save and earn an extra interest income. And that will also allow me to consume more, you know, the next year. So even without deflation, you can see in economies you often have these situations. They're nothing unusual, and it's not an economic problem. So I think that's a very good point. Nassim Taleb is a very interesting writer. And I think there's something to be said for the instability. I mean, I think, in general, looking at monetary systems, it's impossible to have a monetary system or create a monetary system that allows complete economic stability. And the reason is simply that even if you look at the inelastic system, like a proper gold standard, where the money supply is fixed, you cannot exclude that there are periods where suddenly, for whatever reason, the demand for money would change, and suddenly people want to hold more money and we would have a drop in prices. Now, that drop in prices will actually cause that some deflation will cause some of the effects that I just described and attributed to money expansion. For example, it will affect people differently. People who hold more money will be differently affected than people who hold less money. So it will also create winners and losers. So it will create also a certain kind of instability. So what the bottom line is the notion of neutral money is impossible. Money will never just be, you know, a veil that's over the economy and does not interfere with real economic processes. That's impossible. But so the only thing we can argue here is that what is the system that is least disruptive for the economy? And there I would argue, and again hopefully in line with many eminent economists, that an inelastic system is superior. I think my main argument with the mainstream today and with what we hear every day in the media and what's being discussed in financial markets is that people now see it almost the other way. You know, the elasticity gives us stability, and that is a misconception in my view. So I agree with Talib at that point. Gold, of course, gold is just another thing. I mean, why is it gold? I think it's an historic factor. I mean, money is a social convention, it's a social tool for economic interaction. It so happened to be money. Could it be something else? Yes, but if it's a physical commodity, you would have to say that gold, of all the 92 naturally occurring elements in the universe that we know of, gold is really ideally positioned for it, because it's almost perfectly divisible, it's homogeneous, it's easily accessible, it doesn't decay. All the gold that was ever mined is still around and available. So it has many, many advantages. And this is the reason why, for the last 2,000 years, most economies have ultimately drifted towards gold. But could we imagine a new form of money? Yes, we could. And one of the interesting developments, I think, recently, it's just an experiment, but it's very interesting, is the whole idea of Bitcoin. I don't know if you heard of it, but it's because what's interesting about Bitcoin is electronic money, so it's immaterial. If it really is money, it's a cryptographic commodity, so it's designed by cryptographers. It's based on an open source algorithm, so everybody can see the algorithm. But the interesting thing about Bitcoin is that the amount of Bitcoin that can be created according to this algorithm is strictly limited. You can create them by running mathematical puzzles on high-powered computers. You can mine these Bitcoins, it's called mining, and get them into circulation, but the way the algorithm 2140 or something for all Bitcoins to ever be created, and then there will only be 21 million of them. So it's just an experiment and it may never catch on. But at least conceptually, you can see here is something, if people would use this as money, if people accept this as money, then it could be a very powerful challenge to gold. Gold has obviously 2,500 years of history on its side, so it would be difficult to break into those network effects. But I would argue that I think gold, for me, if you leave it to the market, I think gold would win right now. But conceptually, I could see other solutions.
How do you feel about the other metals? Sorry, about platinum, for example, with less people holding on to it, but it's still being scarce and commoditizable.
Yeah, I don't know much about platinum. I have to say, I'm not an expert at it. I think the advantage of gold is simply that it has been used as money for such a long time, and that in all cultures around the world. I mean, if you use a gold coin now and go to many places in the Middle East, you will probably be able to trade with a gold sovereign. So for the market to move over to a different kind of precious metal. With silver, it would be somewhat easier because silver has been also used as money for a very long time, and probably even in more countries for a longer time than gold has. I think the problem with silver, and maybe also with platinum, is the fact that they also have, to a larger degree, industrial metals still. And therefore, sort of the industrial use right now, somewhat feeds back into their prices. I mean, that's a weak argument, because once they become money, the industrial application doesn't matter much, because then the price should be driven by their use as money. But what I'm saying is, like, gold is so as well established as a monetary asset, has such a long history, and it has fewer industrial applications, which is actually an advantage, because
I was getting my head around, that being better that it's less use.
Well, it's not better, but I think the key point here is, and that comes partially back to Noah's question, is Is there something specific about gold? We have to remember that once a substance is used as money, whether it's gold, silver, platinum, paper notes, or bytes on a computer hard drive, just electronic money, once this is accepted as, it is money, and it has exchange value because people accept it as money. Yeah, that is the only thing that gives it value as money. It doesn't matter if it has any other use or application. You see what I mean? It's, obviously, there is this discussion for something to be used for the first time as money. It must obviously have had some previous value, and this is why industrial commodities have the ability to become monies. But once it's money, it's driven by its demand for money, and therefore by its exchange value that it gains as being used as money. Then its use as industrial commodity is unimportant. I just stress this because often people think with gold, they think like, well, sometimes people think, if people argue that there should be have a gold standard, that they think is gold gives money intrinsic value, that suddenly money has, you know, the monetary asset gets some value from the industrial use of that commodity. But that's meaningless, you see, because we can use electronic money today that has certainly no other application and no other use than just being a medium of exchange. So my point here is that sort of the industrial use and application does not really interfere with any of these commodities as monies. But if you look at precious metals, we already have gold. So I don't see how platinum could break into and take the business away from gold, because gold is so established as a monetary asset. I just don't see how that could work. Mm. I can't exclude it, but I would find it very difficult for platinum to take that position away from gold.
Is it gold that you would advocate saving in currently then?
Saving?
Your savings, would you advocate saving in gold currently? Or
yeah, I'm always careful to give investment advice because I did that for 20 years of my career. But I can tell you, I hold most of my liquid assets are gold, physical gold. I hold physical gold as my number one asset. And it's simply, because usually I see the point that people would say, usually in the long run, it should be a bet. Strategy to hold any kind of physical commodity, because I think the whole rise of human civilization and of capitalism has been that things have constantly become cheap. You know, we learn constantly. Becoming more productive means we certainly learn with whatever the input factors are to make more of it. Right? So usually, just betting on commodities it shouldn't be a good play in the long run. But because of the very specific point we are at right now in our financial system, I think almost all the other assets, in particular financial assets, are hopelessly overvalued because we create these massive bubbles. And I think the risk I see is that some of these other assets bubbles could deflate. And also, and obviously, one of the key risks is also that central banks continue to print money. And if we get into a fiat money crisis, people use old established forms of money, such as gold. And people will use gold as a safe haven asset.
So, Senator Rand Paul, who ran for president of America, is quite vitriolic about the Federal Reserve and the Bank of England. He calls them a Ponzi scheme. And I'm just wondering, I've heard that who actually owns the Bank of England? And I guess that's one question. My second question is, you know how when you said the central banks print the money, they give the money to the banks. So what do those banks give in return? So they just get the money. Is that just free money? And so can they just take a bit of it and spend it on buying Ferraris and property and things like that? What happens to the money once it's given to them? I don't understand that.
Okay, the first question, I'm not actually quite sure the ownership structure of the Bank of England.
From what I've heard, it's a privately owned limited company. And that the directors of the company are a state secret?
Well, I know for the Fed, because the point is often when this topic comes up, people quote this thing that the Fed is owned by the banks, and the banks own the Fed. And that is used by many people as an indication that sort of, well, this is not actually the state running the financial system, it's the banks running the financial system. I think that is a legalistic point. I don't think that's true. For the simple reason that the policy of the Fed is being set by politicians, is being set by Congress. When the Fed was taken off the domestic gold standard, there was a decision, as I said, the Thomas Amendment, Roosevelt. When Nixon closed the gold window, he got a couple of his advisors together, Camp David, and they decided to... Bernanke, the Fed chairman, is being appointed by Congress. I mean, this goes through political bodies. So the mandate that the Fed has, and the Bank of England is the same thing, the mandate that these central banks have, what they can do, how they can run policy, how they can run their operations, who runs them, what their objectives are, is all being set by politicians. So the banks, obviously the banks benefit from the central banks. The banks love central banks, at least maybe until we're at the thick of the end game, that can change. Because what banks now realize is that obviously there cannot be government-supported, which there are, state-supported enterprises, and still keep the private profits to themselves. You know, that's why we have now that's why we de facto nationalizing the banking system, which is what we're seeing right now. So in a way, I can see that the banks love to have a central bank because it's a lender of last resort, and it's clear that once you allow your banking system to become big, you cannot allow them to go under. You know, in any capitalist industry, we should see bank or corporations that fail to close. I mean, RBS should be shut down, and Citigroup should have failed, and Northern Rock definitely should have failed. All these banks are still around. Why are they around? Because they now become conduits for monetary policy. You know, the state will not let its conduit for policy go. So the states, the banks have become parastatal organizations. They're not really private, you know, enterprises anymore. At least the big ones. Big banks cannot go under. And how does the process of money creation go? Well, the way it operates, and again, there's some debate. Let me give you two ways of looking at it. Usually it would be that the central bank, if the central bank wants to increase the supply of money, that's how the theory goes. The central bank wants to make sure that we have 2% inflation, so we need to make sure that more money comes into the system than we gain in productivity, otherwise prices wouldn't rise. So the central bank would give extra reserves to the banks. Now, how they do this, they buy assets from the banks. So this is the central bank, usually government bonds, you know, this is the number one asset that central banks use. They can use others, and they have to use others. In the early days of the Fed, and Fed was founded in 1913 and really started operation in 1914, the Fed would only buy trade loans, trade paper. And in the early days, you know, people would have been shocked if the central bank would buy government bonds, because this would be seen correctly as funding the government. But today, most central banks use government bonds. What they do is the central bank goes out, buys government bonds from the banks, and credits the accounts that the banks hold at the central bank with newly printed reserves. So the banks have now just changed in assets, on the asset side of the balance sheet, they changed government bonds for reserves. But now they have extra reserves, and extra reserve means now they can extend their lending business and create more loans out of nothing.
Where did the banks get it? Where did the banks get the government assets to give to the central bank? Is that what you meant? Is that what you said?
But they have their own. They have from deposits. You know, they have invested of all the assets. I mean, obviously, banks have deposits on their liability side and loans on the asset side. But they may not put everything into loans. They may put it into, but it could be loans. I mean, they could hand the loans that they extended over to the central bank. But usually, most of the big banks hold tradable investment securities as well on their asset side, and those are being used for operations for the central bank. But it's a very good point, because it's very clear that this setup makes it interesting for the banks to own government bonds. And whenever the central bank wants to increase the money supply, the central bank will also buy government bonds. So it's clear that this entire system helps the state run large deficits. I mean, this is the reason why since 1971, since we've severed the last link to gold, almost all governments have been continuously running budget deficits, which would have been impossible under a gold standard. Because this system, the banks have an interest to accumulate government bonds because they can hand them to the central bank and retain reserves. And the central bank, whenever they feel the money needs to expand, they use government bonds as an asset to buy and replace with new reserve money.
And do the cost of those bonds go up and down then, based on market forces?
Well, they go up, market forces, but the more involved the banks get and the central bank in the market for government bonds, the more obviously the price of government bonds will be determined by those players and not other market participants. I mean, I would argue in Japan now, where the new policy is to buy more than 100% of the new issuance of the government, which means that the central bank buys all government bonds that the state issues, and no private saver has to put up 1 yen to fund the government. It is done by the printing press. Yeah, that's obviously a very dangerous situation. This is official policy in Japan now. And in this market, I would argue that the price of government bonds is largely manipulated by the central banks. But you know, the price of government bonds is very important because that is considered by most market participants as the risk-free asset. So in terms of pricing other assets, even equities or loans, things are being priced off where the base rate, how you fund the bank at the central bank, which is set officially by the central bank, or by through the government yield curve, which is now manipulated by the central bankers directly. And even there is not even a secret. You know, the U.S. Fed, in their second quantitative easing operation, declared that the goal of their policy is to change the yield curve, to make sure that the yield curve is a certain shape. So the central banks are now in the business of managing all these asset prices, but they are going via the banking system. The banking system is their conduit. Although I have to say that now in Japan, because the banks are so highly geared, already full of government bonds, that now the central bank goes via, around the banking system and directly buys real estate loans and directly buys equities. So trying to get money, newly created money, directly into the equity market or the real estate market without using the banking system is also something I think we will see increasingly in other economies and central banks. But normally, up to this crazy endpoint we now reach, the normal process would be the central bank goes out, lowers official interest rates, which already gives an encouragement to the banks to extend lending, and then they buy assets, whatever the assets are, usually government bonds, whatever the assets banks hold on their asset side, buy them and replace them with reserves. And banks, fractional reserve banks, now they have more reserves, they can conduct more lending. Some people will argue, and I often get that point because there is a whole school of thinking where we always want to put the blame on the banks. You know, I mean, I think the banks benefit from this and they've been complicit in the system, but they're not driving it. But some people argue, no, the banks drive this because the banks lend money, lower their reserve ratios, and then the central bank cannot but give extra reserves to the bank to avoid the banks from being under-reserved. So the banks go ahead and lend, and then turn around to the central bank and say, like, listen, we need more money here, we need more bank reserves. There is some truth to that, but please remember that the central bank has still control over the monetary tools, and a central bank who has the guts to stand up to the banks can still, give them clear indication that they cannot, that they should not run their reserves low. If you look back in 1979, 1980, when the U.S. had fairly high inflation, 10-12% consumer price inflation, Paul Volcker, that became the Fed chairman, he basically stopped the printing press. So he said, okay, he did not print any more money. Short rates shot up to 20%. And the U.S. at the time went through the biggest recession, the severest recession, since the 1930s, that obviously liquidated a lot of misallocations that had accumulated in the inflationary 1970s. But it's very clear that you can do this. You know, you can. The central bank can still hike interest rates and force banks to run high reserve ratios or liquidate, reduce their balance sheet. But usually, it's not politically convenient. And I think the examples I gave in 1998. In 2002, again in 2007, these were all points when it was very clear that the banking system wanted to deleverage, and not because for macroeconomic reasons, simply to protect the capital, they felt overstretched. But when that happened, you know, the central bank felt like they did not want to allow this because they wanted to manage the economy. They wanted to make sure that the economy continues to grow and that banks continue to lend. So although the banks were ready to deleverage and reduce their balance sheet size, the central banks then printed extra reserve money and encouraged the banks to lend again. And this is, again, the policy we see today. So I would argue it's not driven by the banks. Yes, the banks like central banking. The Fed only came about 100 years ago because Wall Street wanted to have a lender of last resort. Banks wanted to have a lender of last resort. The idea of having a government institution that is watching your back is appealing to lots of businesses and so to banks. And yes, legally, the banks even own the central bank. But the way monetary policy is conducted is for macroeconomic policy reasons and is determined by politicians.
Yes. What I'm wondering is, obviously, we've come very far in this process of creating balances and budget deficits over time. If we would actually adopt a fixed monetary system or a gold standard, that would probably mean adjustments that would have then come through labor mobility and wage change. Would these changes be so painful that you can't really go through with it politically?
I mean, it sort of
reminds me of Greece. I mean, if you can't...
It is, it's like, yes, that's Greece is a good example, yeah.
Well, isn't the euro the sort of gold standard itself? I mean, it's failing very badly.
Well, the thing is, like, if it could have been a gold standard. It could have been a gold standard. But obviously, it's just another paper money system. So please remember that I think there are some elements of the gold standard, obviously, in the sense that a country that suddenly is in trouble like Greece cannot just suddenly print its own money. But please remember that under a gold standard, none of these economies would have been in a position to run these big deficits for a long time. You know, the only reason we had a massive housing boom in Ireland and Spain. Some degree in Portugal, massive current account and more importantly, big budget deficits, fiscal deficits in countries like Greece for such a long time, is because of easy monetary policy and this monetary expansion and an assumption by the market, which is partially correct, partially incorrect, that, hey, this is a paper money system, states don't go bankrupt, you know? They will just get easy money. And if you look back, since the euro started in 1999, up to the recent crisis, this was a period of very low interest rates globally anyway, right? So because the Fed was very, you know, from, as I said before, 2001 to 2005, the Fed was at 1%, or 2002 to 2005, the Fed was at 1% in 3 years. But also remember that in 2003, Germany was in very bad shape. And not only did Germany then begin to violate the Maastricht Treaty, which it had not done so previously. But the ECB, it can be argued that the ECB ran a very easy monetary policy to help Germany in 2003. Again, under a gold standard, that would not have happened. You know, Germany would have had to take the pain. And I can understand some of the frustration in the European periphery now, where people say, well, it was that policy that added to the real estate boom in Spain and that allowed countries like Greece to run these budget deficits. So, I think if the Eurozone had really been conceived as a gold standard, or had been a gold standard, some of the dislocations that now haunt the system would not have been allowed to build up. And I think that is, for me, always the strongest argument for the gold standard. It's not how you deal with a crisis. It's the thing that you would not allow, and you cannot, the system would not allow the buildup of these huge imbalances. The imbalances we see in all these European countries that are now in trouble, these imbalances cannot be explained in a hard money system. A dislocated real estate market, to the extent that we have it in Spain, we had it in the United States in 2007, and we had it in Japan in 1989, can only be explained in an elastic money system. But I think there are elements of a gold standard, obviously now, in the sense that I would argue, in Europe at least, you see in some places, that yes, the market is allowed to liquidate. And in Greece, the market is liquidating, well, obviously, Greece defaulted on some of its sovereign debt. I would argue it should have defaulted on more, because it still carries too much debt. A proper default, including of the assets that are held by the ECB and by other international organizations, should have been really better for the country. But at least we see some elements of adjustment, which obviously we all see is politically incredibly unpopular. What I find interesting is the hostility that I sense in the financial industry, the financial market, to these measures. Whenever, you know, there is an idea, recently in Cyprus, where a bank was unbound, and obviously the depositors got hit, at least large depositors got hit, my sense is there's a huge outrage in the financial industry about this. How can you allow this? Which tells you how all the expectations have shifted now. We created a system in which the players in the financial market believe to have constant access to cheap money. And if there is a problem, it will be addressed by the central bank printing and lowering interest rates. So I think to your question, yes, I think if we, let's say there would be a global agreement to go back to a global gold standard. I think it's very unlikely to happen, but what I would say. What would happen? Now, I think the most important thing for me is that at that point, at some point, interest rates would meaningfully reflect again the scarcity of real monetary savings. Because we don't know, nobody of us can tell what the real price of these financial assets should be. What should interest rates be? We don't know. Interest rates should reflect the available pool of savings, you know, the time preference of the public, how many assets can really be allocated to projects that will only give you a return in the future. This is a key question for any functioning economy. To what extent should currently available resources be allocated to meeting future needs, and to which extent present needs? And for that, you need interest rates. But these interest rates, essential market prices, are being constantly distorted in our system. So what would happen is the market would set interest rates again. I would assume interest rates would be higher. I think, therefore, the price of financial assets would be lower. I think a lot of things would be liquidated. I think we would see quite a few banks go under. Maybe some insurance companies, pension funds. Certainly, I think a couple of sovereigns would go bankrupt, such as Greece did, and others as well. So yeah, it would be a very, very painful adjustment process. It has been done before. For example, just to give you one example, the United States went on a paper standard during the Civil War in the 1860s. One of the things, I didn't really speak about the history of paper money systems. There's a chapter in the book about this. It's very interesting to see that most paper money systems came about during wars, simply because that's when the state needed money, and then when they took the currency off gold and printed money. So the US had the greenback system in the 1860s, and obviously had inflation. And in 1879, there was a political decision to go back to gold and resume the gold standard. Very interestingly, the US went through a period of severe deflation, really a very sharp drop in the price level. The economy continued to grow, which is a very interesting example, and actually quite healthy and strong growth. And there is a reference to this in Milton Friedman's book about the monetary history of the United States, when he says, you know, this flies in the face of what most people believe today, that whenever you have deflation, you cannot have growth. Now, having said this, I would assume that if we did this today, because I think the dislocations are now much larger, that I think the fallout would be severe. And because people fear that fallout, I do not think that politicians have the stomach to go through this. So that's why I think they will not voluntarily go back to a gold standard. Sorry.
Yeah, so within the Austrian school, there's the division between kind of the full reserve free banking economists and the fractional reserve free bankers. And in your discussion of deflation, the kind of academy gave of the kind of shifts in money demand was very much in line with the kind of full reserve explanation. So I think the fractional reserve Austrians are generally more kind of interested in by monetary disequilibrium theory. Have kind of raised two possible worries about that, both of which you sort of touched on briefly, but there's the idea of kind of price stickiness, so that if you have a shift in money demand, prices won't move instantly enough, that's in the short run you'll have kind of unemployment. And secondly, when prices do fall, they won't all fall systematically at a nice level, there will be changes in different prices relative. And that causes economic inefficiencies because entrepreneurs to work at an optimal level need prices to hopefully nearly reflect the relative scarcity of goods, and while we're in process of disequilibrium, that's not going to happen, and so you're more likely to get malinvestments. And so this kind of solution, kind of thing like people like George Selgin have discussed, is this idea of fractional reserve free bank, where the idea is that you have banks which will say print up more money in response to rises in money demand, and then will retract these in cases where money demand falls. So I was just wondering where you stand on this kind of, if you have a position on this kind of fractional reserve, full reserve, free banking debate, whether you think those kind of arguments work, etc.
Yeah, I try to give a short answer to this because you touch on some interesting points. I mean, I consider myself a free banker, so I would argue I'm more for free banking. I think the market should decide what kind of money we use, and I think the market would decide some kind of inelastic form of money. So as long as Bitcoin is ready, I think it would again be gold. So let's assume we have a gold standard, a hard gold standard, and then I think we should allow fractional reserve banking will be conducted. I think, as you know, some of the Austrian economists argue that fractional reserve banking is practically a violation of property rights, or some kind of fraud, and therefore in a proper free market economy in which property rights are rigorously enforced, it wouldn't exist. I do not agree with that. I don't think there's anything fraudulent about fractional reserve banking. It looks a bit dodgy, but it's not really, because I do think at the end of the day what people do, well, if you deposit your money into a bank, you should know that you give up ownership of the money. And credit to the British legal system, the House of Lords has actually explained this 150 years ago. They made it very clear: you give up ownership of the money. You now have a claim against the bank, which is something different. And we know the way our monetary system works now is you assume that claim can immediately be turned again into money. Today, even at night, at a cash bank. That's fine, but you also know that there could be times when that doesn't work. When the bank goes bankrupt, you know your money is in trouble. And that's why people lined up outside of Northern Rock. People understand this. So they do. So what I argue, if you deposit money into a bank, you know you give up money, ownership of that money. You know, when you hold cash, you have a form of money that is not at the same time somebody else's liability. It's just you own it. It's nobody's liability. It's just a medium of exchange. The moment you put it into a bank, you have the extra risk, you have the counterparty risk of the bank. So that's where you get interest for the money, because otherwise you wouldn't get interest. So I think it's not fraudulent, it should not be banned. I think one of the points you raised is like, well, if we have an inelastic monetary system for whatever reason, so let's say we have a gold standard, there's very little fractional reserve banking, money is practically inelastic. That would mean you have these periods of deflation, and could that cause on the margin inefficiencies? Yes, I cannot argue against that. My point is the following: injecting money into the economy will create larger inefficiencies. You see, that was the point I made earlier. Money cannot be neutral. So yes, any form of money will somehow have feedback into the real economy, and some of that will be a disturbance. Neutral money is not possible. So by having any means by which you can keep, for example, try to keep the purchasing power of money stable, which I argue is impossible anyway, there's any attempt to do this is doomed. But if you try to do this and constantly inject money into the economy, you will create other instabilities, and they are larger. So I think whatever slight instabilities a fixed monetary system with slight deflation would have, I think are still advantageous to having any other system. My problem with Selgin is simply that I think his assumption that fractional reserve banking meets money demand is wrong, I think, in my view. I think it's completely wrong. Because the fractional reserve banker does not respond to money demand. You know, if I run a fractional reserve bank, let's put it out differently, you have a growing demand for money. You don't go to a bank and take out a loan. I mean, nobody, hardly anybody does that. I mean, I cannot exclude that there is somebody in the economy who does that. But because if people have a demand for money, as I said before, the first thing, if you want to increase your money balances, you either sell something or you reduce your money outlays with the money you spend every day. You reduce that to accumulate money balances. Very few people will go to a bank, take out a loan, pay interest to hold a higher cash balance. But that is the only point where you interact with a bank. A bank is not in the business of meeting money demand. A bank is in the business of meeting loan demand. So the bank deals with completely different people. The person who comes to a bank and takes out a loan doesn't have money demand. That person has demand for goods and services. In fact, that person has a very low money demand because that person has such a high demand for goods and services that he's even willing to pay interest to have his demand for goods and services satisfied now. That is the opposite of money demand. Money demand means low demand of goods and services, high demand of the flexibility that only money gives you. So, and if you look at the process of, to run a fractional reserve bank, you need three people. You need the depositor, who deposits the original money that becomes the reserve on which the central bank, the banker, then can issue more loans. You need the people who take out the loans, and you need the banker. Now, if the banker wants to get more money into circulation, what he has to do is to lower his reserve ratio. That means he issues more paper money or issues more deposit money on top of whatever his reserve is right now. Whether the public has a higher demand for that money or not doesn't matter for him. Because if the public has no extra demand for money, and even not extra loan demand, which is something different, well, he can lower interest rates to get the extra money into circulation. That should encourage somebody to take out a loan. But that person doesn't have money demand. Now, if the public does not have higher money demand, that money gets into circulation, people don't have a higher demand for money, it simply means that prices will rise and the purchasing power of money will drop. If you're a money producer, and a fractional reserve bank is momentarily a money producer, you can print as much money as you like. The public will take it, just as at higher prices, at higher inflation. But if you're a money producer, the lack of money demand is no problem for you. It doesn't mean that any of the money you create sits in your warehouse and doesn't get into circulation. You can always get into circulation. That's the beauty. Money is the most fungible good. And you can place any amount of money because you will just allow the exchange value to adjust. So the idea is, I think that there is this idea with Sargent and also with White, Larry White, I think, the way I understand them, I hope I'm not misrepresenting them, but the way I understand, they have this idea that the free market fractional reserve banks will satisfy money demand. I don't know how that could work, because money demand, people have demand for money, they reduce outlays, money outlays for non-money goods, or they sell non-money goods for money. People don't take out loans, because the person who takes out a loan immediately spends the money. If that person had a higher demand for money, he'd take out the loan and sit on the money, which nobody, hardly anybody does. So my point here is the idea that the banks operate fractional reserve. The constraining factor for the fractional reserve banker is the trust that the public has in the bank. As long as the public thinks the bank is good to go and the deposit money that the bank creates is good money to have, the bank can lower its reserve ratio and create more money. It can lower the reserve ratio, offer more loans at lower interest rates, entice loan demand, place the money in the economy. If nobody wants to have the money, that only means it loses purchasing power. And you don't care about that because you produce at zero cost. So I think there's a misunderstanding about how money demand interlinks with fractional reserve bank.
I think we should bring the proceedings to a close, but we should definitely thank Dele once again for an excellent talk and interesting discussion.